say, I vow to hear the true Dharma throughout this life and infinite lives. It's quite a vow, one must admit. So, by chanting that, it gives us the opportunity to check out if we mean it or not. We'll have several more chances in this lifetime. Let's review the acupuncture needle of Zazen for Zazen thus far. The cliff notes.
Thanks. The cliff notes.
For those just arriving, particularly. And for those who, what?
The blue cliff notes.
The steep, 1,000-mile-high cliff notes. For those arriving and for those who have completely forgotten several days ago when we started. Putting aside Dogen's concentrated effort at commenting on these stories, I think these stories, these three sections of this fascicle, are not talking about different practices. They're just different ways of talking about the same practice. And in summary, I just propose that all these stories are pointing towards the present mirror awareness. The first story was, think of what doesn't think. So, could also translate this as, attend to the present mirror awareness. That which doesn't think. That pure, bright surface from which thoughts come forth, the source of thought, or upon which thoughts are reflected, but which doesn't itself think, the source of mind. Attend to that which doesn't think. How do we do that? We might wonder. Non-thinking. How do you think of what doesn't think? Non-thinking. How to attend to the present mirror awareness? Not by trying to think about it. Just letting go of thought. There it is. Here it is. Ever shining. That's the first story. The second story is with Nanyue and Matsu. What are you figuring to do in Zazen? I'm figuring to make a Buddha. Well, this is like polishing a tile to make a mirror, Matsu points out. How can you make the present mirror awareness through practice like sitting or any way? How could you make a mirror from a tile? How could you make this mirror awareness, period? Because it's unmade, it's unconstructed. And yet, this is, I think, an essential piece that Dogen brings out in his comments. in the very activity of polishing a tile, in other words, sitting upright, still, silent, with a relaxed yet alert body and mind. This is like polishing a tile. In the polishing the tile, the mirror is revealed. It's not that that's making the mirror, not that the zazen is making the mirror because the mirror is already here, but the zazen is revealing the mirror, which is pretty much the same thing as how do you attend to what doesn't think, this mirror that doesn't think, by non-thinking, sitting upright, letting go of all that discursive activity about the past and future. I propose it's the same instruction in just a different way. And then that story goes on to say, well, if your cart doesn't go, do you strike the cart or strike the ox? Do you try to manipulate your physical posture a little bit to rest in this mirror awareness? Or do you just attend directly to the mirror awareness? And the original story, it seems to be implying, strike the ox is like, attend directly to the mirror. Don't get too caught up in the outer form, because it's not in the outer form of the upright posture. But then Dogen's comments do say, actually, in the Buddha Dharma, we have cart striking and art and ox striking. We attend to body and mind. We attend to the details of our tangible practice by taking care of our posture and our breath and our heart and mind, as well as attending to the present mirror awareness. And they actually go together and they can't really be separated, the cart and the ox. And then Matsu's story goes on to say, just to emphasize the same points more, in a non-abiding dharma, there's no grasping or rejecting. Non-abiding dharma is the present mirror awareness. There's no grasping or rejecting there of all the things that are placed before it. When someone from Santa Cruz comes, it reflects the Santa Cruz person. When someone from San Jose comes, it reflects the San Jose person. Equally, without embellishing, adding or subtracting, grasping or rejecting. And then we have, if we grasp the marks of sitting, like the upright posture, the breath down in the abdomen, the mind of clarity and ease, these are all marks, characteristics of zazen. If we grasp those, this doesn't reach the principle. This doesn't reach the principle here is also the present mirror awareness. So that's where the story, that's kind of summing up. There was some other stuff in there too, right? And we talked quite extensively yesterday about this last very dynamic part of Dogen's comments If you grasp the mark of sitting, you're not reaching its principle. And Dogen says, since we cannot fail to grasp it, in being seated Buddha, we cannot fail to grasp the mark of sitting. We're always grasping it. And though our grasping the mark of sitting might be crystal clear grasping, we are not reaching its principle. We never actually reach the present mirror awareness. This kind of concentrated effort, this whole picture, is called dropping off body and mind. Very challenging and unusual way of talking here, Dogen. And we've talked about that quite a bit already, but I wanted to bring up another commentary on that section by Katagiri Roshi. So he translates a little bit differently. He says, Nanyue says, if you attach to the Zazen posture, you cannot reach the truth. That's what he calls the mark of sitting, grasping the mark of sitting. And Dogen Zenji's comment is, attaching to the form of Zazen means that you have to abandon the usual understanding of the Zazen posture and touch the heart of Zazen. It's true that you cannot avoid detachment from the Zazen posture. Since there is no detaching from the Zazen posture, it is not to reach the truth, even though attaching to the Zazen posture is clearly transparent as a jewel. It's a little, same idea, a little different, but basically the same point is that you can't not attach to the Zazen posture. In other words, as long as we have a Zazen posture, we're grasping the mark of Zazen. But knowing that any idea of the Zazen posture we have doesn't reach this present mirror awareness, realizing that any idea about the present mirror awareness never actually touches the present mirror awareness is called dropping off body and mind. So then Katagiri Roshi says, people usually understand Nanyue's statement to mean don't care about form, because that's just you're just attached to the form, you're missing the heart of the matter. You're grasping the carved dragon instead of the real dragon. They think it means that you don't need to be concerned about the form or posture of Zazen because you cannot attain enlightenment that way. But this is a misunderstanding. Dogen Zenji says we have to abandon our usual understanding of the Zazen posture and touch the heart of Zazen. What is the heart of Zazen? To know this, first you have to throw away the usual sense of form. If you touch the heart of the Zazen posture, the usual form of Zazen is dissipated very naturally. So, touching the heart of Zazen, not the form. And then his next sentence is, touching the heart of form is very important. I think implying that we touch the heart of true Zazen through touching the heart of the form. So, as we know, Sesshin is just like, we're totally immersed in form, particular ways to do everything, all these ceremonies and rituals. We, in our tradition, we call forms, keeping the forms. touching the heart of form is very important. For example, if you're an expert mountaineer, you have to carry many things when you climb. Clothes, boots, food, medicine, ropes, and so on. But if you climb on a hot summer day, the form of the mountain, the form of your body, and the form of your equipment all bother you. You want to climb with your body half naked, not carrying anything. So why don't you leave all that stuff behind? You cannot do it because you love being on the mountain. You cannot hate your clothes. You cannot leave your equipment behind. Those things bother you, but you have to carry them. Sometimes it might feel like this in Sesshin. Do we really have to like chant all those ancestors again? It's like, it makes me sweat. Can't we just go to the straight to the top of the mountain without all this form? All this equipment, all these Orioki utensils and cloths that have to be folded just like that, they bother us. Can't we leave that stuff behind? He says, you can't do it because you love being on the mountain. You can't leave the equipment behind. It's not that you have to carry them, all this equipment. It's that you want to carry them, because without those things, you cannot be on the mountain. I think for a mountain climber, it's really not realistic to say, like, I'll just go naked to the top of this high snow mountain and camp there because we'll just freeze to death, die immediately. We need all this, you know, we're these fragile humans. We need all this warmth and mountain climbing gear. And so this is it's talking about Zazen, right? It's like, to be on the mountain, we need all the equipment. It's kind of like to really rest in the present mirror awareness. We need good posture. We need a particular spot, a particular room and cushion to sit on, and all the forms that support our practice. At least we need some particular form. We could say, well, we don't really need the form of Sesshin. We can access the present mirror awareness because it's not made by polishing a tile. It's accessible and available anytime, and this is true. And yet it's harder to climb a mountain, really enjoy that snowy peak of the mountain. Without this equipment. At least that's one way to look at Sesshin. That's maybe the practical way to look at Sesshin, is all this stuff that we carry along supports us to just totally settle into the present. That's the practical way, I say, because we talked about yesterday, the true purpose of Sesshin is just to do it. It's just like anything else. It's not really necessarily more supportive than anything else. It's just, this is, when it's time to do this one, we do this one. And when it's time to, you know, go back to work, we do that one. And I like how he says, it's not that you have to carry all this stuff, it's that you want to carry it, because without those things, you cannot be on the mountain. So we can reflect, do I really want to carry all this stuff? Sesshin? Forms, for example? So it's really love that's bothering you. You love the mountain, so you accept the form of being a mountaineer. You love the present mirror awareness, so you accept the form of eating Orioki. Somebody mentioned to me in Dokusan, you know, I feel like, it seems like Dogen's never really talking about love. And I thought, yeah, you know, he's not really big on that word. He talks a lot, but it's not one of his favorite words. I thought, does he ever mention it? And like, well, I think he implies it a lot without using that word. I thought, and then I remembered, oh, actually, in this fascicle, he does use the word. Maybe you recall from many days ago where he says, rather than love the carved dragon, you should go on to love the real dragon.
Indeed.
Mm. So there it is. Dogen's talking about love. And I think it's basically the whole thing's about love. Because, and when I think he does talk about love, he usually is talking about loving the real dragon in so many words. Yeah. So, and then he kind of brings back in the carved dragon too and says, but also carved dragons have the ability to produce clouds and rain. But Sashin is basically a love fest. we're just totally into loving the true dragon, to loving the present mirror awareness. Isn't it so sweet? And I think when we start to, you know, settle into it and appreciate it more, how can we help but love it, actually? It's really love that's bothering you with all these forms of Sashin. You love the mountain, so you accept the form of being a mountaineer. The same applies to the Zazen posture, or the form of whatever you do. The Zazen posture is really painful, creating lots of stiffness, just like climbing a mountain. But you love something that is at the heart of your life. In order to climb the mountain that's called life, you have to carry a form. It bothers you, but you do it anyway. Then when you touch the heart of form, form creates beauty. This section of commentary is called Creating Beauty. So you also might feel like, well, this polishing the tile stuff and, you know, resting as the present mirror awareness, this doesn't sound like creativity and beauty. Katagiri Roshi is an unusual commentator in this way. He's bringing out this point. If you practice Zazen by throwing away the usual sense of Zazen form and touching the heart of Zazen form, which I think we can mean by like touch the heart of Zazen form, but not the usual sense, means you keep the form, but then there's like a form within the form. I think Sashin is the best time to appreciate this when you're just like doing these same activities over and over again, and you feel as if you start to really embody them. Yeah, like you feel your body is happy to just like be in this form, and we're all kind of in it together. So it has this is, I think, hard to talk about, but maybe you have this experience. I think that's when I think things like service and Oryoki, these things are like, as Sashin goes on, for me, they really come alive. It's not just like going through the, like, how do you do this again? Okay, what's the next? Oh, yeah, it's not just going through the motions in the same way that it might be in daily practice. In Sashin, maybe more than usual, it's like you, sometimes the bow is just like, you feel like your body is completely like lined up with the body of the bow. Sorry, I don't know how to talk about this more. But you know what I mean?
For me, I noticed the handing off the incense.
Yes.
Because there's such a simple thing.
Yep.
And sometimes you're like right on, and it's just like, meaning it's this just sort of.
Yep. That's a good one.
Chanting, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Chanting, sometimes we all just like.
Yeah.
Comes together, we're kind of all.
Exactly.
Separate beings, and then we just kind of all become kind of one.
Little things, you know, little things where we, and often it's like, yeah, this way we meet in the silence. Oryoki, there's many things like this. I feel like one of them is when the server's coming, to clean the meal board. At the end, when we bow to pick up the bowls, there's this sense of timing that's just like, I really just love these little moments. They're walking towards me like this, and I'm like, okay, here we go. And then there's a certain point, this very intuitive point where it's like, they're walking, and it's like, and bow and pick it up, and then, you know, when it works just right as the bowl comes up, they go down, and shook. And then I try to put down my bowl really quick, and then meet them in the gusho, and we bow together. And it's just like a dance, you know. And sometimes you can really feel that, like, there's almost no thought behind it. That's why I think it's so enjoyable. And because the repetition, the regularity of the forms is, I think, offers that chance, because the more we get used to them, the more we start to just embody them in this kind of more and more natural way. At first, it's kind of clunky and awkward, and this doesn't feel natural. But I think more and more, you could choose virtually any forms and do them long enough, and you start to feel that. So if we don't feel that, then that's kind of like a nice incentive to just keep doing it again and again and again and again. And then sometimes there's like little kind of magical moments. And I was thinking, this happened in this sesshin, and it happened in some other sesshin, because I remember talking about it in some other sesshin talk. So maybe these things only happen in sesshin, or maybe they're only noticed. But I think it was yesterday, as Doshi, I was holding that stick, right? And I went up to the altar to offer incense, and I went like this, and I came up, and there was a spider from the ceiling had come down, and it was moving in the air like that, and it came down right like this, and I maybe had to adjust a little bit. I just went out like this and caught it right on the end of the stick, and then I just walked out the door, and I don't know if you noticed that. And like, that was like perfect timing, that spider. How did it do that? And I remember that happened once before. Right in the center. Yeah, they're like Zen spiders, like trying to dance in the form with us. Yeah.
When it happened the first time, you imagined that they finally made it here to hear the Dharma and
take him
out.
Oh, yeah, or some apology, right? So, yes?
I do notice things like that happen all the time, and I don't always notice.
Yeah, so maybe that. Maybe just in sesshin, we're just more aware.
We slow down.
We notice details more. And, funny. Sometimes just little things. Like, you know, where we pass the same spot again and again, and then in sesshin, you pass the same spot, like a corner of the building or something, and it's like, wow, I never noticed that before. Yeah. It's tuning us into the present experience, which is, again, I think related to this mirror that's just reflecting what's put before it. When the mirror is really, really dusty, like it might often be in our usual life, the big things shine through the dust, right? But the little things are obscured. So when it's kind of polished, a little more clean in sesshin, even the little things are reflected very accurately. So if you practice zazen by throwing away the usual sense of zazen form and touching the heart of zazen form, so this is how I was thinking of, it's not just going through the motions, but when you're like, your body feels like it's immersed in the form. That's how I would hear this. Touching the heart of the zazen form, you see something beautiful. At that time, there's nothing to actually see, nothing to actually touch. There are no principles of practice, no training, no discipline, no truth. There's only form. When only form blooms its own flower, there's no space to bring anything into it, not even truth, because it's completely clear and transparent, just like a jewel or a mirror. This is called creativity. Within creativity, there's two points. One is attachment to form, the other is detachment from form. In detachment, form is still there, but that form is completely different from the usual sense of form. So it means detachment from the usual sense of form. Detachment doesn't mean you should ignore form. It means you have to attach to form through and through. A form may bother you, but you need form because you love truth. You love peace. You love life itself. When you touch the heart of Zazen form and manifest maturity, there is creativity. Within creativity are all the forms you practiced in the past, but creativity itself has no form. You don't know what it is, but like the diver on a cliff, all you have to do is stand up there. All your practice and hard work in the past disappear completely, leaving nothing to depend on. But even though there's nothing to depend on, there's hope. There's a chance to manifest the maturity of all the practice that you've done in the past. How? Jump! Then the whole of existence, past, present, and future, comes together and works together. This is called moment. Moment. Or present. We return to the acupuncture needle. We finished the non-thinking story and the tile polishing story. Know this, that it is the seated Buddha that Buddha after Buddha and ancestor after ancestor have taken as their essential activity. Those who are Buddhas and ancestors have employed this essential activity. This is, we're going to get to this in the upcoming poem, begins with essential activity. Those who are Buddhas and ancestors have employed this essential activity, while those who are not have never even dreamt of it. Now, to say that the Dharma of the Buddha has been transmitted from the Western heavens to the Eastern earth, which is a poetic way of saying India and China, the Western heavens of India, implies the transmission of the seated Buddha, for it is the essential function of that Dharma. And where the Dharma of the Buddha is not transmitted, neither is seated meditation, or Zazen. What has been inherited by successor after successor in this transmission is just this method of Zazen. One who does not participate in the unique transmission of this message is not a Buddha or an ancestor. When one is not clear about this one Dharma, he's not clear about 10,000 dharmas or about 10,000 practices. And without being clear about each of these dharmas, he cannot be said to have a clear eye. He's not attained the way. How could he represent the present or past in the lineage of the Buddhas and ancestors? By this, then, we should be firmly convinced that the Buddhas and ancestors always transmit seated meditation, Zazen. So, Dogen's building up to his rant. He always has to have a little rant. get a little critical. Part of his personality, as we know and love him, in his many fascicles. I'll just a word about Dogen's rants. Because he's going to start kind of ranting a little critically here. It's a little hard for me to take sometimes, these, Because we have a precept about not speaking of others' faults. So what about this? I hear it as he's talking to a particular audience of his students, very sincere practitioners, and he's getting kind of like energized, and I hear it as like his incredible passion for practice and truth, and it sometimes gets a little heavy-handed, but I hear it, to turn it in a positive way, I hear it as this guy is like wildly passionate about zazen, about practice, and about true, deep understanding, thorough investigation, concentrated effort at getting to the heart of the matter. He's so into that and wanting to convey that, that he sometimes has to say, there's really these people who really don't get it. And like, you people that I'm talking to now, please get it. Very few people get it. You, please, with me, let's all get it. Get to the heart of it.
Isn't there also, I mean, the historical context, I think, plays a part here, where, you know, he was really frustrated with some of the institutional practice, right? My understanding is that there was, you know, people who were selling, you know, transmission, and who said you don't have to, meditation doesn't matter.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, so I think that, you know, just as now the times we're in 200 years, they might look back and say, wow, they were kind of fixated on this or that.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a way too that different, you know, especially formative teachers,
mm-hmm.
He was a man of his time.
Yep. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And trying to find, and I think that's part of why we revere Dogen, is because he wasn't just going along with the style of the times that was like maybe he considered to be a kind of halfway or lazy version of zazen, something. He's like, let's really do this. And then I myself find it hard to take the rant sometimes. It's like, I think it's meant to be inspiring to like, let's really find our way. And sometimes he's not criticizing particular people, and maybe he doesn't even have particular people in mind, just the certain styles of practice, which he's going to get into some specifics, and he has already. Sometimes he brings up names. Usually not living people. not his friends. sometimes, I guess, maybe.
Reminds me that, what was the word he used to describe Catherine? Because Catherine could really rub people the wrong way.
Mm.
But my sense was that she was kind of passionate also.
Yeah.
And but there was some word that he used to describe.
Said ruthless because of the pitiless love that she had.
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's
ruthless.
Formative teachers especially, where they just, you know, that's, oh, you know, kind of why they're here, in a way.
It's,
that's their function,
mm-hmm.
is to wake people up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So they're that stick.
Mm-hmm. Very strict and very loving, ideally, at the same time. Because it's very easy to get, like, very strict without the underlying love that it's based on. Dogen tells stories about his teacher, who'd come around in the zendo and hit everybody and say, come on, wake up. And he said that everyone in the zendo would start shedding tears, but not because they were being hit, but because like they could feel his love. And I've sometimes talked about various teachers of mine in America. Tenzin Roshi has a very strict side. But particularly I think of Tongan Roshi I practice with in Japan. Really could be quite scary sometimes. but it felt like you really could feel his love. I don't think it was just projection, because sometimes it would come out in just a very cuddly kind of way. And you'd say, you'd really know he really loved people and he loved practice and he was really totally devoted to the people he was practicing with. And because of that, you know, one of his phrases is, don't look off. Don't basically get distracted from the heart of the matter. And when he felt like people were, he could, you know, be quite strict. Some people like personal stories. And so I'll tell one more that maybe the personal story theme for this session is about the practice in Japan with Tangen Harada Roshi, because I mentioned several other from that particular practice place and teacher. One time I might have told this before, but this was a while ago, but like little things stand out from that year. We took turns timing periods, like basically the Doan and the Doan was the same role as what we call the Junko, who is like circumambulating incense, round of incense. Junko means, but it's the person who carries the Kyosaku, the long stick to wake people up with. So it's like the Doan basically would go in, ring the bell three times to begin the period, and then they would pick up the Kyosaku and make the rounds of the Zendo. And at the end, there's a whole ritual of putting the stick back on the altar, because it's Manjushri's sword, and then ringing the ending bell. And then you the little plaque you pass to the next person just goes around the Zendo in order, and the next person, it's kind of nice, so nobody has to sit. Here too we rotate the Doan, but there it's one period at a time, you time, and then you carry the stick, so you kind of miss your zazen a little, that period. You're basically doing kinhin with a stick. And I was that person at one time, there's basically like a clock on the Zendo wall, and that's like the Doan clock. Because there's no Doan seat, right? You're walking. It's like this one particular period is like, okay, so the 40-minute period, it ends there. Somehow I seem to like have miscalculated and I was just walking and walking, and it didn't seem like a particularly long time to me. It was kind of like the Jisha Ino person, that was kind of like the same role too, started like looking up like this. Everyone's facing the wall, right? But you kind of like look, kind of make faces. I'd be like, why are you looking? Concentrate on zazen. I should probably hit you. and just kept going, and various people started going and looking around. And the teacher was sitting there too, and I don't think he made any special faces. But like, you know, things kept happening like that. Like these signs kept coming, and I just thought, what's with these people? And I'm like, it's like, is there something wrong with the time? Like, no, it's the time. And then I went back, like, it ends at the time I decided it was gonna end. 10:20, whatever it is. And then at some point, it's just like that little like bell goes, wait a second, I should check again. You know, like, oh, that's the time. Oh no, it was like 20 minutes off or something, you know. I'm like, oh, I thought it was all about them. It's all about me. Quickly, put the stick down, ring the bell, get up. Oh. And then everyone's standing there, about to start kinin, and then the teacher comes over and with one of these, you know, he kind of grabs my head and I kind of like in his elbow and goes, and I was like, ah, oh.
You knucklehead.
And then afterwards, like, during Kenan or something, I saw that one of the senior monks outside, and he was like, Oh, Roshi gave you a love knock. Anyway, to be illumined by the radiance of the Buddhas and ancestors means to concentrate one's efforts in the investigation of this seated meditation. So we might think, to be illumined by the radiance of the Buddhas and ancestors means to just sit zazen and the Buddha's inconceivable light will just radiate on us. That's kind of nice. To be illumined by the radiance means to concentrate one's efforts in the investigation of this zazen. Dogen's really pushing, like, don't just kind of hang out there in your old understanding of zazen. Make concentrated effort to investigate this, and in that concentrated investigation, Buddha's light illuminates us. Some fools, misunderstanding the radiance of the Buddha, think it must be like the radiance of the sun or moon, or the light from a pearl or a fire. But the light of the sun and moon is nothing but a mark of action within the realm of transmigration in the six destinies, the six realms. It's not to be compared with the radiance of the Buddha. So the Buddha's light is not like physical light in the world. This word is komyo, radiance, that refers to both, Buddha images have a halo. Other religions have also, interestingly, huh? A halo around their head and body sometimes too. And we might call aura. There's a kind of subtle light scientifically speaking, people say there's various tools that can measure these different frequencies of light around people. So I think there's something. I think aura is not a completely made up thing. And these big halos of Buddhas, maybe there was something quite visible there to people with the Buddha. But he's saying that these physical visible light is not this inconceivable spiritual light. Dogen has a fascicle called Shobo Genzo Komyo about this light. The radiance of Buddha, or the brightness or light of Buddha, means receiving and hearing a single phrase, maintaining and protecting a single dharma, participating in the single transmission of seated meditation. So long as one is not illumined by the radiance of the Buddha, he's not maintaining nor has he accepted the Buddha Dharma. So again, I think quite interesting that the radiance is this kind of active process of hearing, maintaining, and protecting Dharma for us to do. This being the case throughout history, there have been few who understood seated meditation as seated meditation. And at present, in the Chan monasteries of Great Song Dynasty, China, many of those who are heads of the principal monasteries do not understand and do not study Zazen. There may be some who have clearly understood it, but not many. Of course, the monasteries have fixed periods for Zazen. The monks from the abbot down take seated meditation, zazen, as their basic task, and in leading their students, the teachers encourage its practice. Nevertheless, there are few abbots who understand it. I mean, they were talking about this whole land of people practicing zazen, and they're actually sitting on the cushions practicing, but few of them actually understand what is actually happening, what the practice is, Dogen is saying. For this reason, although from ancient times to the present, there have been one or two old worthies who have written texts known as inscriptions on seated meditation, Zazen Nei, or like the song of the trusting mind is the Xinjin Nei, or Xinjin Ming in Chinese. That Ming means like inscription or song. So there were some zazen, mei, principles of seated meditation is zazen gi, of which Dogen wrote a zazen gi, but there were others before him. Or lancets of seated meditation, zazen shin, acupuncture needles. Among them, there's nothing worth taking from any of the inscriptions on seated meditation and principles of meditation are ignorant of its observances. They were written by people who do not understand and do not participate in its unique transmission. Such are the lancet of zazen in the Qingde Chongdeng Lu and the inscription on seated meditation in the Jia Dai Pu Teng Lu. So all these kind of maybe popular meditation manuals in China at that time, Dogen's basically criticizing almost all of them, thinking they're all missing the point. What a pity that though the authors of such texts spent their lives passing among the Chan groves of the Ten Directions, they do not have the concentrated effort of a single sitting. That sitting is not their own, and concentrated effort never encounters them. Which, that's a nice phrase too. It's not that they're not making concentrated effort, it's that concentrated effort never encounters them. In other words, it's not a matter of carrying the self forward and practicing concentrated effort. It's that concentrated effort comes forward and verifies ourself. It's not exactly our concentrated effort. It's the Buddha's light. Because if it was just our concentrated effort, we'd probably never make it through 5 days of sesshin. Something larger is supporting us here. This is not because zazen rejects their bodies and minds, but because they do not aspire to the true concentrated effort and are precipitately given over to their delusion. Again, it's not that zazen rejects them. Instead of saying, it's not that they reject zazen. I mean, he's saying, and it's not that zazen rejects them, because zazen doesn't reject anyone. Zazen is in this, you know, without commenting on it so much, he's just, by putting the sentence that way, implying that zazen is this gift that's coming from the Buddhas, and it's coming to everybody, and it doesn't reject anybody, but without true concentrated effort, almost like maybe they reject it, right? Zazen's compassionately saying, please let me practice you. And we say, no, not now, I'm working on my posture. I'm trying to fix up the, what I think is the form. They do not aspire to the true concentrated effort. Mm-hmm.
So it's the lack of aspiration.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a nice point, that it's not even so much that they're making the concentrated effort, but we start with just aspiring to concentrated effort. Again, this concentrated effort is, in Chinese, gong fu. So I think there's many kinds of gong fu. I don't really know the martial arts world so much. It's kind of connected with martial arts, right? But gong fu literally means just like concerted effort, doing some activity with great energy and effort. So I think they even call, I think they call it the tea shop down the street. If you want like the Chinese tea ceremony, you can, on the menu, you can order the ceremony. And it's like, I think they call it kung fu. Does anyone know about that? I think they call it like, you can just order a cup of tea, or you can order like the whole kung fu service.
Yeah.
It's an amazing place. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very traditional kind of Chinese tea shop where they'll you can just buy the tea, hundreds of varieties, plus, this kind of service, and maybe the implication is it's like they're their concentrated effort to serve you in this kind of formal way. Kufu in Japanese. What they have collected in their texts is these texts he's criticizing is nothing but models for reverting to the source and returning to the origin, vain programs for suspending considerations and congealing in tranquility. So as often when Dogen criticizes his views, I think we've said before because he did it earlier in this essay, his criticisms are not like really blatant, obvious things. Often what he's criticizing sounds pretty good. You know, so in this case, reverting to the source and returning to the origin sounds a lot like turning the light around to shine back at the source, which is how I was trying to speak about think of what doesn't think. Thomas Cleary was too. So do we hear it as that same thing, or is it something that almost the same, but maybe like just getting stuck in a kind of empty blank source? We don't know exactly what he means, but vain programs for suspending considerations and congealing in tranquility sounds a little more problematic.
It sounds a bit sarcastic.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like that little edge.
Mm-hmm.
He's using the language, but kind of
yeah.
Maybe in the translation something's off.
Yeah, congealing, and sounds like getting really, really comfy in a very, very settled, tranquil state, and just like very kind of dark cave zazen they sometimes talk about, right, where it's just like very comfy, warm, cozy zazen here, but like, and I hope nothing disturbs me because it's so cozy here, and you know, it's very like, it's not so lively. Like a darting fish. Let's just see about these two types of zazen that he's critical of, just to hear some other translations. Going back to the source or returning to the origin and vainly endeavoring to stop thinking and become absorbed in tranquility. We've already talked about this week. It's not about stopping your thought. Or Kaz says, aim to return to the source and origin, trying to cease thinking and be still. So maybe that really is the point here, is this trying to stop all thought is not it, and be still. If the Buddha had to stop all thought, he couldn't help anyone. Vainly endeavoring to cease thought and become absorbed in serenity. This is inferior to the stages of reflection. Such views of meditation do not approach the stages of observation, exercise, infusion, and cultivation, or the understandings of those in the paths of the 10 stages and the equivalents of enlightenment. How then could they be the single transmission of the seated meditation of the Buddhas and ancestors? The Sung chroniclers were mistaken to record these texts, and later students should cast them aside and not read them. All these different things he mentions here, without going into details, they're all just different types of meditation, particularly in the Tian Tai school. That list is a classic list, apparently, of Tian Tai meditations, which Dogen, even though Dogen grew up in the Tian Tai school, was ordained as a Tian Tai priest and kind of like converted over to Zen, he, you know, it really implies that this Zen of the ancestors is this unique understanding of basically everything. And again, we can hear lots of like sectarian type of thinking in this kind of talk of Dogen, but I'd like to hear it as just his passionate love for his unique path that he's just trying to convey. Maybe when he actually got together with the Tiantai people and the other ones, they just enjoyed a hearty laugh and cup of tea together. I hope so.
Well, it kind of reminds me of cutting through spiritual materialism. I mean, it's that,
Trungpa.
Just, I mean, it's that same kind of thing. It's like, okay, are we doing this just to kind of accumulate more of the same?
Yeah.
Is that what we're about?
Yeah.
Like, okay, we're dying here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is life and death. And
yeah. Cutting through spiritual materialistic views of other traditions, and then he's got to be careful not to have his own, you know, Soto transmission of the ancestors' spiritual materialism too. And you know, if you read what he's trying to say, in the end, it's just vast, spacious emptiness without any boundaries of any particular traditions. So in that way, it's free of spiritual materialism, and yet it's expressed in all these particular ways, and Dogen is like crazy about the traditional form must be maintained just like this because it's the way it was done. You know, we have to, and with ourselves, in our modern practice, we have to keep looking if Are we slipping into spiritual materialism? It's very easy, I think, to do. Especially when you're really devoted to maintaining a tradition, which we are. It's a fine line. Because then you say, oh, we don't want to get into that, and you throw out the baby with the bathwater. And I think this dance, this middle way, is Dogen's actually is playing with here by saying, some people interpret this story of polishing the tile to make a mirror as throw out all the form because the mirror's always here. You don't need any particular thing. That's spiritual materialism. And Dogen would say, yeah, the mirror's already here, but we need a practice to actualize it.
Who brought Zen from China to Japan? Was it Dogen?
Well, there's these two, there's the Linji and the Saodong, the Rinzai and Soto lineages, right? So Dogen brought Soto lineage. He was the first Soto practitioner and teacher in Japan, looks like. He went to China to get the lineage, brought it back. But just before him, like during his life, the teacher Eisai also went to China and brought the Rinzai lineage to Japan. So same time, right there in the beginning of the 13th century, both streams of Zen arrived. So technically Rinzai arrived like, I don't know, 20 or 50 years earlier than Soto, almost same time. And Dogen practiced first, when he first decided to practice Zen, the only place in Japan was this one Rinzai temple where this one teacher was. It's just beginning, kind of like this time in America.
That's what I was thinking about, was he bringing a form, new form,
yeah,
and not having grown up with it,
yeah,
was obsessed with form because he was bringing it the same way we, when we get it, as not having grown up with it, getting it transmitted to us, like by Suzuki Roshi, we become obsessed with form until maybe, hopefully, something takes.
We then we slowly adapt it. I think, and maybe the way we adopt it is, as Katagiri Roshi was saying, it's like you have to abandon your usual sense of form and touch the heart of form. So maybe when we can really touch the heart of form, where that feels like we're embodying it completely, then from that space, then we can start to change it. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's one way to look at it. I think Suzuki Roshi did say something like that. He's like, you people will need to change these forms in America, but please don't do it too quickly until you really understand what they are and how they work, because then you'll lose something really precious if you do it too quickly. Yeah. And then so there's the danger of too quick, and then there's the danger of too slow. So, but it's funny that, you know, Dogen, there's already Buddhism for a long time in Japan before Dogen, but there just wasn't this special transmission of Zen. And the forms were actually quite similar. It wasn't as unusual as Zen coming to America, you know. But there were particular things that he emphasized from the kind of, from the Chinese Zen monastic manuals of how to do ceremonies and things that were a little different. And that was maybe part of it. It's like, we need to establish our unique thing, so let's do the ceremony a little different like this. And things like Orioki, I think, was actually a Zen form that maybe wasn't around in Tendai before. And it's funny that, you know, it's 800 years after Dogen, but there's still this sense in modern Japan of, like, enshrining just the way that Dogen brought it. And he, so it's basically Song Dynasty Chinese practice is being carried on in Japan and America. I mean, Santa Cruz Zen Center is pretty Song Dynasty China style in most ways, many ways, straight from that time. Whereas the funny thing is, if you go to China, they actually, they're not Song Dynasty anymore. They actually changed, I mean, the basic forms are the same, but the services and the ritual elements and the robe style, things like that, gradually changed. But in Japan, they're like, because we revere Dogen so much, it's like, let's just do it just like that. There's something really wonderfully sweet about that too, I think. I mean, I personally like to, you know, see just how Dogen did things and like, yeah, let's try it just like that. But like out of devotion to Dogen, but spiritual materialism is like lurking all around this territory. We have to be careful.
It is now, isn't it, in Japan?
Spiritual materialism?
Yeah.
Maybe we could say spiritual materialism, we could maybe define as like when we lose the heart of the matter and it just becomes like an empty shell form.
That's my impression.
And I think, you know, there is that story. I think it depends, mm-hmm. you know. Like the place I practiced in Japan, it felt like the heart of the practice was really alive. Mm-hmm. And sometimes places like Eheiji, which is like the Vatican of Soto Zen, get a little criticized because they're the really exact form, you know. And the people there, it's kind of this prestige about practicing there, and most people very, very short time. Like, you just, you know, you're the son of the temple priest. You go to do your training for half a year, maybe at Eheiji, and then you come back. So that all these young, priests born into the job who, like, aren't really so into Zazen, maybe. But like, well, okay, we'll go do this Eheiji thing. And then there's people like Koben, our founder here, who was the Ino at Eheiji. And he was apparently just really into Zazen. They don't do much Zazen there, but he would sit Zazen and kind of on his own and felt like there's this real heart of the practice. And it's here at Eheiji, too.
So what's the origin of the Zazen posture, considering the Kali and Mudra?
Yeah, I think that goes all the way back to the Buddha in India. Like, I don't know if there's any sutras that talk about that mudra in particular, but statues and paintings Buddha from ancient India. We still have stone statues from really ancient India that have that mudra, and they have this posture, and they have the cross leg.
But it wasn't called Zazen until it came to Japan, is that?
In China they called it Sochan. Pretty early on, sometime after Bodhidharma. Like by the time the sixth ancestor definitely used the term Sochan, Zazen, sitting Zen. And that was like early China. And but Dogen says, even though they didn't use that in that term Zazen in ancient India, that's what the Buddha was doing. Well, whether or not that's true is, I don't know, but that's his total faith. That the Zazen he's speaking of was the Buddha's practice, and that's what's been transmitted from the Buddha up to the present. Yes?
I have a question. Did Dogen talk to people who were lay people and householders and encourage them, or was most of his focus on strictly the monks and his strict interpretation of Zazen in the context of like the monastery?
Yeah, that's a good question, because we're always reading stuff in context, right? So both. He definitely taught both, and I don't know if there were lay people living at the monastery. In the modern movie version of Dogen's life, there are, actually. And like in modern Japan, like the monastery I practiced, there were lay people as well as ordained priests living at the temple. And then many people, it was in the town, like Santa Cruz, and there were many people from the town who'd come after work and stuff, kind of like this. It was a monastery, but it was a town temple also. In Dogen, I think that sometimes Dogen, later Dogen scholars look at certain fascicles and they can tell by the way it's written, or sometimes he even writes or something, that it was taught particularly for lay people, and some were taught particularly for the monks in the monastery, and some for both. So my sense is that this fascicle might have been taught more for people in the monastery who were doing Zazen all the time, partly because this is really unusual what we're doing in America. This is like we do like lay practice, intensive Zazen and daily Zazen. All Zen centers in America, Zazen is the central practice, and they're mostly lay centers. So I think this is this amazing gift of American Buddhism that we're offering to the world. Like, look, anybody can do this practice, and this is what we're actually interested in. Whereas if you go to Japan, in modern times, so probably at the time of Dogen too, Zazen itself, just meditation practice, was seen as kind of like an esoteric practice. That seems funny to us, right? But in those times, and even modern Japan, if you say to somebody, I'm going to on the street, I'm going to a Zen temple, or going to practice Zen, they say, oh, wow, that's really difficult. There's this almost like mystique around Zen practice. It's like, it's very, to actually sit Zazen, you have to be really into Buddhism to do that.
So it doesn't sound like they encourage it so much then. Kind of.
I'd say, I don't know if they encourage, in modern times, I think there's encouragement. Like there's groups for lay people to come and sit. But Dogen definitely encouraged it. And so we don't know, maybe it was different, maybe more people were practicing. I think when he gets really into these detailed kind of instructions, maybe there were a whole bunch of lay people who were really into Zazen. I'd like to think so. I hope so. It's hard to know, actually. But Dogen specifically does say, in especially a lot of his early writings, when he's first setting out his understanding of Zazen, he's really promoting it for everyone, for lay people, and he specifically even says, even sometimes criticizes, like, if lay people are really devoted to Zazen and they're wholeheartedly practicing the way like this, that's, you know, more worthy practice than ordained people who don't. You know, because this is the point, this is the heart of the matter. So, yeah, Dogen, you know, that's another nice point, because when Dogen can sound kind of like, when he's on a rant here of criticism, and we can hear Dogen as sounding quite sectarian, there's this other side of Dogen that, especially for his time and culture, was very liberal and open towards especially lay people, maybe more than other texts from that time, specifically teaching lay people, and very open to women, which was unusual in Asia at that time. There's a whole fascicle praising women practitioners called Raihai Tokuzui.
But they couldn't be priests.
Yeah, they could. Yeah. There were women priests too. Yeah. In fact, I think most of the ones he's praising were these Zen women teachers. And he gets into a rant, a typical Dogen rant in that case. But in that case, his rant is about people who think they shouldn't have women in the monastery, they're not, you know, they're second-class practitioners. Because people in Asian culture, still there's some of that feeling around a lot of the world. I think that's another great gift of American Buddhism, that because we aren't into that kind of division. So we're just like, anybody can be, women and men can be Zen teachers. Priests and lay people can be Zen teachers, in America especially. We're really into like not discriminating in that way. But Dogen, I think, was ahead of his time. We might criticize him for, he could have been more open and non-sectarian, but for his time and culture, I think, he was pretty open. And I think he ordained nuns. He had women priests practicing with him. Some of the women ancestors we chant are Dogen students. Egi is, I know she was a student of Dogen. Maybe Shogaku, I can't remember all of them.
And where is those writings that you about the women and the nuns?
There's this one of the Dogen wrote that's particularly about this called making prostration and attaining the marrow. It's about this issue of women practitioners. It's in the Shobogenzo. You can read it. Raihai Tokuzui. And in general, about this, there's several books. There's one called Women of the Way that's kind of like the lineage, sort of, not exactly lineage, but like all the women ancestors from India, China, and Japan with their stories in a kind of modern, somewhat embellished for entertaining reading version. Almost like Records of the Ancestors, but it's all women, called Women of the Way. We have in the library here, and another one called Zen Women, that's more like a scholarly historical overview of India, well, more in particularly in the Zen tradition and issues about that. So it's a whole kind of field in American Zen and Buddhism now. Yeah. Among the lancets of seated meditation, among the zazen shin, the acupuncture needles, the only one that is an expression of the Buddhas and ancestors, according to Dogen, is that by Reverend Chung Chui Chan Master Hung Jir of Qingde Monastery at Tiantong, renowned Mount Taibo, in the district of Qingyuan in the Great Song. Can't quite say it in one breath. It's like Dogen, when he's going to maybe especially praise someone, all their kind of like names and locations and every detail about them. Just like, this is, in a way you could say, it's the particulars of this particular person. This one is a true acupuncture needle of Zazen. This one says it right. It alone radiates throughout the surface and interior of the realm of the Dharma. It is the statement of a Buddha and ancestor among Buddhas and ancestors of past and present. Prior Buddhas and later Buddhas have been lanced by this lancet, have been poked by this acupuncture needle. Present ancestors and past ancestors appear from this lancet. Here is that lancet of seated meditation. Are you ready? The Lancet of Seated Meditation by Jung Jue, by imperial designation, Chan Master Hongzhir. So Hongzhir is one of Dogen's favorite ancestors, lived only 80 years before Dogen in China, was the abbot of the same monastery where Dogen practiced, although Dogen was no longer alive. Mm-hmm.
Was this master in Dogen's lineage?
No, not exactly. He's a kind of cousin, or what would you say, like once removed, or I can't remember exactly how it goes. But he's not in our lineage that comes through Dogen. He's a little offshoot, but he's Soto because he's an ancestor of Dongshan. So Soto Zen and Hongzhir first in Sung Dynasty, maybe one of the most important teachers in China. He is the compiler of the Book of Serenity, wrote all the verses in this of this 100 koan collection. I think they usually say the one who wrote the commentary in the Book of Serenity is a different teacher, and he says, now let's hear from Qian Tong. That's referring to Qian Tong Hongzhir. Qian Tong Ru Jing was Dogen's teacher. They're both named after the monastery, Qian Tong. Hongzhir also wrote, has this extensive record, some of which is translated in the wonderful book Cultivating the Empty Field by Taigen Leighton. So those two books, particularly in English, we have of Hongzhir. He was like the most important Soto ancestor in China at that time, maybe most important or kind of outspoken person in the Rinzai lineage in China at that time was Da Wei. And Dogen's often quite critical of Da Wei. And those two were, Hongzhir and Da Wei were contemporaries and apparently friends and lived kind of nearby in China. Were corresponded with each other, but kind of this sort of rivalry too, or it's like, at least that's how the stories come down to us, is it's like they, it looks like they would criticize each other somewhat, but then when the scholars have unpacked it more, they say, well, actually they were really good friends, and they were just trying to bring out the Dharma by bringing up two different sides of practice. There's a whole book, I think a whole book on this time period in China and these two teachers and how and the kind of latest historical research called How Zen Became Zen, just a couple years ago came out. Hongzhir was known for what was called silent illumination, which is, some people say, is the Chinese equivalent of shikantaza, or just sitting. You can read the introduction to Taigen's book talks about this. And Da Wei was known for koan practice and like bringing koans into meditation to work with them. And just like in modern Japanese Soto and Rinzai, there's kind of different emphases in practice. In a way, it's kind of started in China, like this, with these two lineages. Hongzhir was a very literary person, amazing poetry, if you know Cultivating the Empty Field. Beautiful and subtle instructions about the mind of Zazen, I would say, most of his poems. Here's one of them called Zazen Xin. Essential function of all the Buddha's functioning essence of all the ancestors It knows without touching things. It illumines without facing objects. Knowing without touching things, its knowledge is inherently subtle. Illuminating without facing objects, its illumination is inherently mysterious. Its knowledge inherently subtle, it is ever without discriminatory thought. Its illumination inherently mysterious, it is ever without a hair's breadth of sign. Ever without discriminatory thought, its knowledge is rare without peer. Ever without a hair's breadth of sign, its illumination comprehends without grasping. The water is clear right through to the bottom. A fish goes lazily along. The sky is vast without horizon. A bird flies far, far away. That's one translation of this poem, of which later we'll see that Dogen will write his own based on the same sort of structure. And you maybe have to spend some time with the poem to see the structure, but maybe you could hear it in there, that these kind of like matching, there's these two streams of verses, right? It starts off with, knowing without touching things, illuminating without facing objects. And then the verses kind of like take each one of those lines and they keep adding another piece to the line, but they're alternating in between. It's really a really neat way, I think, to write a poem. Do you see how that works? It knows without touching things, it illumines without facing objects, then it goes back to knowing without touching things, this knowledge is inherently subtle. And then it switches back to the second line. Illumining without facing objects, this illumination is inherently mysterious. It's almost like a formula where you could plug in these characters and just keep building this like chain of commenting on the mind of Zazen, like two interwoven chains. You can, if you read it on your own a few times, you can see how he's constructing it, and Dogen constructs his in the same way. And so now, then that Dogen will now comment line by line, pretty much line by line on this poem. I think he skips a few parts, and he skips there's a lot of repetition, so he skips the repeating lines. But I think one of the hearts of this poem is this, it's talking about the acupuncture needle of Zazen. This is knowing without touching things and illuminating without facing objects. That's kind of the heart that the rest is built on. Basically just kind of praising that kind of mind, how mysterious and subtle it is. It's basically what he goes on from there. But if we're linking together this whole fascicle, in summary, again, think of what doesn't think. Attend to the present mirror awareness. How do you do that? Non-thinking. And then the mirror, this present mirror awareness is not created by polishing a tile or any particular practice, because it's always with us. So that's the first two stories we could say are different ways of talking about the present mirror awareness. This poem too. The present mirror awareness knows without touching things. Touching means, like we talked about yesterday, some like contacting a thing outside ourselves, a thing like an object separate. So this present mirror awareness, if it's a non-dual awareness, therefore it can't touch something outside itself. If the awareness, like our dualistic consciousness, here's a piece of paper, and our consciousness, our mind consciousness, is kind of making contact with the object out here, a mental object, or also just our visual consciousness is contacting the visual object, and our mental consciousness, the idea of the paper, is contacting, or the consciousness that's aware of the paper is contacting the mental construction of a piece of paper. That's what we call dualistic consciousness. Basically, that's operating all the time with us also. Maybe except in like deep sleep. So this mirror awareness is something that's also operating all the time, but it knows, in other words, it's an awareness. It knows, it's aware, but without touching things. It's a non-dual awareness. It doesn't contact things. And at the next line, it's the same thing. It illumines without facing objects. I thought, well, if we talk about the mirror, don't we say the mirror faces the objects? So it might be stretching the metaphor here with the mirror, but think of the mirror. Say this mind is a mirror. You put an object in front. The object, a piece of paper in front, in the mirror metaphor is quite nice, right? Because the object doesn't really touch the mirror. Right? There's a reflection on the mirror, and we even say that the reflection doesn't really touch the mirror, right? What is that relationship between the appearance on the mirror and the mirror itself? It's not really that it's touching it, but it doesn't stick to it, right? It doesn't, the mirror is not grasping that object. It's just a mere reflection in the mirror, but the mirror really is, we could say, aware. But it's not aware of an external object.
It's the function of light and the eye.
Yeah.
It's kind of what's going on.
The function of light and the eye.
Because the light is kind of bouncing, this thing.
But we're talking about, in the mirror metaphor, again, like this is a metaphor, so we might not be able to stretch it too far to suit our needs. To the very end, right? But in the mirror awareness, we're not talking about the us looking in the mirror. We're talking about we are the mirror itself. So in that way, there's not even any consciousness is happening. We're the mirror that just receives the image, and the image doesn't actually contact the mirror. We could say, oh yeah, the image is right there on it, but it's not exactly contact. It's more subtle and mysterious than contact, isn't it? So I think in many ways, I think the mirror awareness applies quite well to knowing the way that a mirror knows those images. They're really reflected right there very accurately. It doesn't block them. Blocking them would be like not knowing them. In a way, the mirror knows the image, but without touching it. It's just a reflection, an accurate reflection without embellishing it, without adding or subtracting, and without touching it. And same with facing it, it illumines without facing objects. I understand it's the same thing, just another way of saying it's talking about the subject-object relationship, objects and things. There's no external things and objects in both these cases that are faced or touched, and yet there's knowing and illumination. It's bright and clear. And that combination of non-dual, because there's no object or thing, and awareness, because it's not just like non-duality itself in some abstract sense. We're talking about this is a live awareness. We can call that non-dual awareness, or as Hungjur called it, silent illumination. In a way, the silence is like the silence from the silence around objects. We're not getting involved in the external objects. This awareness is not getting involved in external objects. It's silent around words and objects, and yet it's illumination. So that pair, mokusho in Japanese, is silent illumination. In fact, the show is the same show as Illumined here. Silent Illumination, which was criticized by Da Wei, that Chinese rival, for being kind of quietistic, they sometimes say, like too passive. Silent Illumination is like almost like congealing in tranquility, or so that's how he saw it. And that was why they had this rivalry. That was what the rivalry was about. Da Wei saying, that sounds like congealing in tranquility. And Hung Jir saying, well, your kind of koan approach to attain some special enlightenment sounds kind of dualistic. Or kind of like polishing. It sounds a little bit like polishing a tile to me. I don't know exactly how he said it, but that was their distinction. And still, in modern Japanese Zen, you have these arguments. Soto Zen gets criticized sometimes for being too kind of passive and falling into the silent side, gets too emphasized. And Rinzai Zen it gets criticized for being too into like doing something and trying to get somewhere. So this afternoon we can start seeing Dogen's comments. Anything to bring up? Just like all of these teachings in this fascicle, just like any Dharma teachings, just like any teachings from any spiritual tradition, it always seems it's worth mentioning that these are all to free us, and particularly these types of teachings are meant to be applied to our zazen. It's not just a kind of like literary exercise. It might be that too, with this kind of thing. But to try to take in the whole thing at once, you might end up just like being totally obsessed with thinking in zazen. But you could take up one line, and if you think of what doesn't think, spend a whole period, just let's practice that. Or in a non-abiding dharma, there's no grasping or rejecting. Or the mirror is not created from polishing a tile. Or now we have knowing without touching things. Jhumir Samadhi would say, turning away and touching are both wrong. Same idea. Like we're talking about and this is actually quite literally about the jewel mirror samadhi, how the jewel mirror samadhi works. Turning away, be like, you know, blocking off the mirror so there's no more reflections, no more awareness. That would be like congealing in tranquility. Turning away from any experience, that's wrong. But then touching the objects before the mirror, having the mirror reach out and grab the physical object, that's wrong. So then we say, well, what's right? Turning away and touching are both wrong. Well, it's like a massive fire. Just to depict it in literary form is to stain it with defilement. Yeah. So, again, we can't really say exactly what to do. It's just not this and it's not that. Blazing fire.
Did Bob Dylan read Dogen?
How so?
Well, it just seems like some of his poetry.
Similar.
The imagery and the way he just pulls things.
It's true, yeah.
Amen.
It, kind of magical.
Yeah, Dylan does have some similar qualities stylistically to Dogen. I would say so, actually, yeah. In fact, Tigan Layton is totally into Bob Dylan, and he's you may have seen, he's got an essay on Dogen and Dylan. Where is that essay? It's in one of those books, compilations. Yeah, he basically brings up various Dylan songs and comments on them from Dogen's perspective.
Well, it's one thing. Something arises and we meet it, but we don't touch it.
Mm-hmm.
How do we meet it?
In some ways you could say it's not really meeting. The way we think of meeting, you know, we never really meet anything. I mean, meeting usually implies like I'm meeting you, but you could say truly, if we look really carefully, there's no such thing as meeting, because everything is one massive fire. So we can't really meet, which is a little bit like that saying of Baijiang is like, if you see how mind and objects never contact or never meet, you're set free on the spot. Something like that. Yeah, so, yeah.
Because I...
Conventionally, there's meeting. We're meeting.
Yeah, I mean, what Chuck said about being motivated to be of service and to help. And
mm-hmm.
To be a part of the betterment of life.
Yeah.
To be a Martin Luther King. When I see, you know, marching and meeting. And,
mm-hmm.
Contact and
but
then again, everything, it's all just one fire.
Yeah, so both sides, yeah. And again, this is the two truths. There is meeting, and yet not. All objects and the senses interact, and yet do not. So there is meeting, like, is the appearance of meeting, and that's our work. And the Sesshin is all about meeting ourselves and meeting each other. And then now we're exploring this unusual realm where nothing ever meets because nothing's ever separate. Meeting can only happen when things are apart and they come together. So maybe to be Martin Luther King, first we see how it's like a massive fire, and we can't meet anybody because we're like, it's excruciating intimacy. We're just one being here. If we kind of get a sense of that more and more fully, then we can go out and meet from that place. Yeah, yeah. Like we start from the. It's kind of like maybe Zen style. Start from the ultimate, and then come into the relative.
It informs the action.
Yeah, it informs the action. This year we're going to study Dongshan's five positions. This one's, I feel almost regret for having put that on the calendar because like, this is going to be tough. But these five positions are the interfusion of the relative and ultimate of these two truths. And that just came to mind when we were talking, because it's like, in that sequence, you start with like, total darkness, like the ultimate oneness. And then from that come forth into the relative world. So I just came to mind, it was like, there is practical application to things like these five positions. Coming from the ultimate into the relative. Yes.
So just in the continuation of that discussion then, is that ancestors coming for those who have passed, and is it that kind also, not only just the living beings, all of them, all mm-hmm. the essence that is here on the planet now, or mm-hmm. wherever, farther, mm-hmm. does it also include, because in your chanting you talk about the ancestors.
Of old, yeah.
So does it, is that inclusive in it too, the study that you're about?
Totally, yeah. I mean, because here it is, right? We're like bringing up these ancestors. We're exploring how to practice in the present moment through the words of someone 800 years ago. So, and he's bringing up stories of people, you know, several hundred years before him, and they're trying to carry on this tradition of several countries and centuries before them. So it's amazing. I think that's like this, it's amazing to me, this, the way that this thing, this massive fire just keeps getting like passed along and transformed and played with and almost maybe goes out sometimes and then blazes up again and it's tended, the fire is tended by all these particular people throughout time and space. And even after they're gone, it's so wonderful that after they're gone, they still are alive. Here we're grappling with this guy who's like, in this particular day, and they say what day it is when it was presented in January or something in Japan 800 years ago, he happened to get into this rant. And here we are talking about Dogen's like particular rant from 800 years ago. Like, that guy really lives on. But in a way, all of us are doing that too. We're all like changing the world in everything we do all day long, and transforming the whole in our little unique ways. And that's all part of the fire. Yeah. All Buddha's 10 directions, 3 times means past, present, and future. All included. May the merit arising from this discussion illuminate all beings in 10 directions and 3 times. And may it help them to illumine without facing objects. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable, I vow to become it.